Welcome back to the Brew Theology Podcast and our live podcast event, Soul Brew. During this event, we talked to Rabbi Stephen Booth Nadav, Buddhist priest Diana Thompson, and Pastor Nathan Hoag. During this event, we're going to talk to them about how they nurture their internal spiritual life and how that helps them create healthy community. We're so glad you could join us. We're going to jump right in. Here's part one.
Welcome, everybody. Thanks for being here. We're Denver Brew Theology. So I'm going to tell you, And I'm going to tell you a little bit about what we're about tonight. Before we get started, we're super excited you're here, though. Welcome to Soul Brew, Crafting Badass Communities. We have a really badass panel here with us tonight. These are the stars of the show. Exactly. So I'll make it quick, and then I'll get out of the way so that they can do most of the talking. My name's Rob Carroll. I co-direct the Denver Brew Theology Community with Janelle. And Ryan was with us in Denver and now is the director of the Waco chapter. And he and Janelle kind of run Brew Theology nationally. We have a Tallahassee chapter, a Waco chapter, Denver chapter.
Two Atlantas.
1KC. Yeah, it's a national deal. I know. Isn't that crazy? Denver Brew Theology, we're an open and accepting and affirming community, right? We have everybody here from atheists to Christians, to Jewish folks, to Buddhists, and across the gamut, religious nuns, people who claim no religion. Awesome. Cool. You want to talk about life's most important things? You want to do it over a beer? You want to clink glasses with somebody who you might even have differences with at the end of the night? Then we're your place, right? How many places in society, you know, can you do that? We want to be one of those places. Talk about the most important problems, but have community, know that we have differences, and really, like, we try to come to the table with an ethic of love, an ethic of community, an ethic of understanding. And at the end of the night, you learn something about yourself. You learn something about other faiths. You learn something about community. So that's what we're about. Check us out. Come back. We're on Meetup, Denver Brew Theology. We want to hang with you. Come join us. And we have drinkers and non-drinkers alike, so don't feel pressured to drink beer. But Grandma's beer is great. With that, a couple logistics items and housekeeping items. Feel free to get up and go get beer, whatever you need to do. We will have a break, though. We're going to do about 45 minutes for section one, a little bit of community in the inner part of community, and then a little bit of community in the outer part of community. So we're excited to do that tonight. These folks are amazing for joining us. We have Rabbi Steve, we have Reverend Diana Thompson, and we have Reverend Nathan Hoag, who are all going to join us. We got some OGs from the Brew Theology community. Rabbi Steve and Reverend Diana. And then Nathan, you keep saying, I'm just going to listen. There's a reason you're here. Please bring all of yourself here. And we're looking forward to your voices too. We'll have some question and response. Without further ado, snacks. There's concessions in the back, but the stuff's free. You should go back there. There's Cracker Jacks, Baby Ruth, Twizzlers. It's all baseball themed, folks. We got opening day for the Rockies tomorrow. They might be horrible at baseball, but we're all going to go sit in a stadium. Some of us are. Enjoy the concessions. Without further ado, I will hand it off to our hosts, Janelle and Ryan. Thank you so much for being here, and enjoy the night.
Thank you. Thank you, Rob Carroll, and welcome Mile High City to the spiritual grand slam of the night, Soul Brew, crafting badass interfaith communities, and this is a live podcast. We were doing this 11 months ago, and afterward, we had Mark and Pam doing Torah. Yeah, and then there's a day after I was at Wash Park, and I was like, hey, we should do another one of these, and those that know me know, yes, I'm a Christian, that's my label, but I'm a wannabe Jew. And then over the years, I've kind of flirted with some Buddhism as well. So I hear a Jew boo's a thing. And so I was like this contemplative mystic aspect of life, but there's something missing here. So we started to sort of talk about this a little bit. And the first person on my list was Rabbi Steve because, and Steve, no, we have others. And you're not the only reason that I want to be a rabbi. It's because he allowed me to come in on his turf. I went to one of his seders. He took us on a spiritual hike at one point. You talked about Abraham, Joshua, Heschel, so all this awe and wonder and the contemplative stuff. So I said, Steve would be great at this, to which when we asked him, he said, well, I'm not really much of a mystic. Well, I go, well, to me you are, I mean, compared to this guy. And then Diana, she's the same. She's like, well, I'm the only Buddhist you know. That's not true. But when I met her, I thought, she's a badass. And she's not your typical kind of Buddhist. I thought, maybe she sits around and meditates all day. And I think 7 years ago, you said, no, that's not the case at all. And I can actually pronounce Jodo Shinshu after all these years. Yeah. But Diana will teach us something. She's taught me a lot throughout the years. And then Rob kept saying, there's this guy in Inglewood, Sacred Grace, doing some really awesome stuff. And he's like, just look him up. He said this a couple times. So I finally was like, okay, let's look this up. And we looked him up. And sure enough, Nathan was like the person of the year in Inglewood in 2021. So my question is, what happened the last 2 years? Yeah. Yeah. So he's basically living the Christian life that I wish I was in a lot of ways. So he also went to the same seminary, and that's pretty cool too. So we're excited to have you all. And Janelle, do you have anything else to add before we start? We're going to do two truths and a lie, but we need some help from the audience right now. You remember this game back in middle school, high school. So these three have two truths and a lie. They're going to come across like either they're all ridiculous lies or they're all ridiculous truths. And you're going to have to decide which one is true and which two are true and which one is false. So all we need is just three people to guess. Or you can just yell a lie if you want to do that too. If you don't want to come up, we're just going to do it communally. All right, we're going to do it that way. Who wants to go first over here? Two truths and a lie. Just to get to know these three.
In the mic? Yep. Is that okay? Okay. First of all, thank you. This is really an honor. I really appreciate this. This is great. I thought about this more than I should have today. I probably should have thought about the actual questions, but I'm very excited for this part. So I'm glad we're doing it and that we didn't skip it. I got to remember them now. Okay, first, I worked at a distillery in Denver for 10 years alongside being a pastor. I've ridden my bike the entire length of the West Coast of the U.S., and through foster care, my wife and I have had 40 kids in our home. Those are three things. Good luck.
You want to take a guess? What's the lie?
No, the bike's true. Distillery is true. We haven't had 40 kids in our home. We've had like 35 kids. Not quite 40 yet. We'll get to that milestone at some point. It'll be great.
All right, Steve, you want to go?
And I sent Ryan a message. I sent Ryan a message today and said, I'm not good at this. Tell me what I should say. And then I thought of something, and they're not funny, but we'll see. So one, I sailed 7 Chicago Mackinac sailboat races, the longest annual freshwater race in the world. And a couple of weeks after her second place finish last week, I had an email exchange with Cole Brower, the first woman to circumnavigate the world solo, nonstop, in the global solo challenge. So they're either both true or they're a lie. Two, I have helped Palestinians pick olives in the West Bank, led tours of Gaza, and have 2 Palestinian citizens of Israel as heart daughters. Three, I have also hiked the Israel National Trail from a lot in the south to near the Lebanon border in the north.
So you've only done 4?
Anybody else want to take a stab?
You think number one's the lie? Number one is true. Oh, that's great. 2's also true. 3 was the lie.
We got somebody back here saying you didn't do the hike.
Not yet. But a buddy of mine just did it. That's what made me think of it. Okay.
Nice.
Diana.
Okay, so let's see. Bali, Indonesia, took the wrong boat on a tour, ended up on a sketchy island with a petting zoo where I got bit by a monkey. Number 2, Alameda, California, cleaned a house, which I was doing when I was in grad school. The house was a ranch style in a suburb where he had many stuffed animals, lion skin rug, etc., etc. But the weirdest thing I saw was when I went to change the sheets on their bed, and their handgun was in a tube sock. Number 3, Berkeley, California. A man is standing in my front yard, no pants on, palms faced up, tells me that he is there simply because he has been cast out and is communing with God. I leave him alone and go back into my house because who am I to bother somebody communing with God? I win $20 with a lottery ticket the next day. My neighbor, who chases him off, falls down the front steps of our home.
I'm not buying Indonesia.
What's the lie?
Number one.
Went, no, that one's true. Totally got bit by a monkey.
Number two's the lie. The tube sock's the lie.
Tube sock, totally true. And to this day, why is your gun in a tube sock? How is that protecting your home? So yes, number three. There was a man in my front yard with no pants on communing with God, but it had nothing to do with our luck the next day.
So you're going to get testing, to know these testing. Three a little bit better, and what this is going to be kind of like speed dating in a way. You all in the back, you can keep your questions for the very end, so you'll have questions after we break, and then we'll come back again. The first part of tonight is going to be the inner self, their spiritual practices and whatnot, who they are. The second part of the night's gonna be the action part, the crafting of the badass communities. And so just keep that in mind and write down your, you have pens, you can write your questions down, but save your questions till the end. You all can ask each other questions throughout, but also know that we have a time constraint as well. So without further ado, the inner badasses that you are, who are some of the badass people? And Steve, I know you would ask, like, what is badass? It's just anybody who's actually held any kind of influence, power, in a good way, over your life that has shaped you throughout the years. Faith leaders, they could even be rock stars, I don't know. And why were they influential?
Oh, okay, Diana was gonna start.
However you want.
You said Steve.
Okay, all right. Well, I had a question for you about be here now, be somewhere else later, what's so complicated? Anyway, so who are my spiritual mentors? Briefly, two people who I never met and two people I did. Mordechai Kapp, and how much time do I have for each question?
3 minutes.
Three minutes, okay. Wave at me.
Oh, okay.
Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, who wrote a book called Judaism as a Civilization. And he made it possible to see ourselves as fully American and fully Jewish at the same time and to not leave our rational thinking minds at the door when we go into synagogue to pray. A colleague of his was Abraham Joshua Heschel, who I'm going to quote from a little bit later, but he was from a long line of European mystic rabbis, actually, and was saved from the Nazis, came to the United States, and taught about spirituality and the intersection of that with social justice. So when he went to Selma to march with Martin Luther King in the Selma to Montgomery march, and people asked him, well, how could he be doing that on the Sabbath? And he said, I felt that I was praying with my feet. Third was Rabbi Lynn Gottlieb. She's still alive, but she was the first woman rabbi I ever met, an amazing storyteller. I'll never forget the first time I saw her. She told stories of the women of the Bible and totally brought them alive. And it was like, I had no clue. It was just, she's total badass and very inspiring. And lastly, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, also a good friend of mine now. I don't know, wild and crazy guy. I don't know what to say about him right now. He wrote like 40 books. You could look him up.
Cool. Thank you.
All right, so for mine, just because it's been on my mind recently, a mentoring minister of mine, Reverend Dr. Segen Yamaoka, who was just the kindest, most soft-spoken man and did the most amazing talks all the time. And he taught a class at our seminary school that every single one of us that took his class while taking it didn't know what he was talking about at all and thought it was just a complete waste of time until we had to write our final papers, which required us to take a moment and look more deeply into situations that had to do not with our academic spiritual life, but with our personal spiritual life. And he did a lot of really amazing things. He was the bishop for a while, got us connected with the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley so that our seminary school was actually legit, helped all of us, as far as the ministerial students, to not only encourage us on our paths, but also did crazy stuff. My scholarship didn't come through on time one year, and I was upset about it and told him about it. And then 15 minutes later, I got a call from the office saying suddenly it was in. And I don't know where that appeared from, but he was an overall badass and really helped all of us to kind of see things again, taking us out of that academic space where we are all in when we're in seminary school and bringing it to how are you actually going to do this when you become ministers. So he was one of the biggest influences.
The first person that came to mind when I saw this question was Frederick Douglass, who is an American abolitionist, but spread abolitionism all over the world. And this last summer, my wife and I had the opportunity to follow in his footsteps in Scotland and understand a little bit more about what he was about. Another person that comes to mind is Howard Thurman, who's had a significant influence on me because of the way that he has woven philosophy and spiritual practices together at the same time. Those have, in my experience, oftentimes been oil and water, very separate from each other, and he's found a way to put them together, which was wonderful. Fleming Rutledge continues to be a hero, an encouragement, someone that I can always count on, whether it's her homilies, which many of them are written out so that they can be read and ingested that way, or John Perkins and his justice work around the U.S., and my grandfather, Don. I don't think I would have any perspective on or desire to be in the mountains the way that I typically am and do if it wasn't for him. He helped me understand that part of our state in a way that I don't think would have been available to me without him. So those are some people that I think of and look to when I think of heroes in my life.
Awesome. Thank you.
In the few seconds I still have, I forgot a really important person, Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who was one of the reasons I moved to Denver, one of the reasons I got to rabbinical school. Father also barely survived Europe getting out from the Nazis, and a bridge. He was 50 years minimally ahead of his time in his thinking, and he said to me when I was thinking about going to rabbinical school that the one I was considering, where he was teaching at the time, was the only one with soul, and it was the only one worth applying to. And he would call me Stevela.
Nice. Well, that was a great bridge. We were wondering if you'd be willing to share with us a pivotal moment in your spiritual journey that led to a deeper understanding of your personal faith. So from our Christian lingo, that might be when we got saved or sanctified or went to camp or went to a revival.
Saved again.
But for you, do you have a moment that you'd be willing to share with us that there was a pivot moment for you and what that was like and how it's continued to influence you? We're going to keep throwing questions at you.
We even have them in front of us, Steve and I do.
Two things. One is I was in my 20s. I was in the North Woods with three Native American tribes on a Three Fires gathering, guest of Eddie Benton Benet, an amazing Ojibwe teacher, founder of the Red Schoolhouse in St. Paul, Minnesota. I was living in Minneapolis at the time, and I noticed that we were welcome but not really being welcomed into the stuff happening in the campgrounds, you know, for that couple of days. And he came by to check in on us, and I asked him, like, is it really okay if we're here? And he said something that changed my life. He said, no, of course it's okay, you're here, you're my guests. But we're used to white people coming and just ripping off Native American culture and leaving, and there's nothing in exchange. But you, and he points to me, he says, but you come from a rich tradition. Why don't you go learn and then come back and we'll have something to exchange? And I credit him for sending me to rabbinical school. And then in a similar vein, in my second year after rabbinical school, I was camping in Canyon de Chelly, an amazing holy place on the Navajo Reservation. I was very lucky to be part of a group of rabbis and Native spiritual leaders camping with the last grandfather who was living in the canyon year-round. This is about 30 years ago now. And I woke up, the short of it is I woke up one morning and I realized what I most love. This was like, I suddenly saw myself in a deeper, clearer way. And I realized, what do I most love? I most love doing Jewish, being outdoors and physical. And it's like, so that sort of churned through the rest of my career. Some years later, when I was doing a bunch of multi-faith stuff, and I thought, well, how does that fit into the doing Jewish outdoors on physical stuff? And I realized, where did I learn that the most important things to me were doing Jewish outdoors and physical? I learned it as a guest in an earth-based culture that was not my own. So that put all of them together.
Thank you.
Shall I? Okay. When I first heard the question, I was thinking about something that caused me to reevaluate my faith. Maybe not so much something that sparked or began my faith, but 10 years ago or so, when my wife and I started taking foster kids into our home, one of the placements that moved in is trans and bisexual. And all of a sudden, my evangelical upbringing, all the things that I had learned or been told or was supposed to parrot or believe, all of it kind of turned on its head. And I had to reevaluate so many things that I had been told and so many things that I had read and so many things that I believed, because now I was responsible as a father to a person who really didn't have any reason to trust me or to care about me. And I had to, at this point, learn to care about them, even if it took them a while to learn to care about me and reciprocate that. And my faith at that time, the way it had been given to me, had sort of served as a barrier between me and them. And it caused me to rethink and reevaluate so many of the things that I had been brought up in. And since then, we've had a number of kids who were either trans or homosexual or, you know, all, kind of across the spectrum, different than me, different than what I had grown up in. And it gave me an opportunity to rethink my faith and rethink the way that my faith would interact with somebody who's different than me. And so I think back to that time, most of the time when I think about, gosh, when was the time when my faith sort of turned upside down and had to be reformed? And that was one of them.
Yeah, that's a turning point for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people leaving more traditional faith is encountering LGBTQ folks and realizing, oh, they're just like us. Yeah. Diana?
This was a really difficult one for me because there's so many moments where, yeah, I don't know that necessarily pivotal, but definitely came across as something that helped me along my spiritual journey. And it was, it's a hard one to choose because even just now, Rabbi Steve mentioning his journey, and there was a moment that I had very early on when I became a minister where an unhoused man came into the temple just seeking some solace, basically, and he and I started talking, and he was a veteran, had grown up on a Navajo reservation, and we started talking about our two religious faiths that we got brought up with, and there were so many intersections within that in and of itself was a really sort of amazing moment, just knowing that from two completely different areas of the world, we found all these intersections within my personal Pure Land Buddhist tradition and the Navajo spiritual tradition that he had gotten brought up with. But also there was a moment near the end of the conversation where he opened up a little bit and told me that he had been in the military and in his time in the military had ended up contracting AIDS. And his home community had kicked him out because of it, because there was a stigma around that. And so he had been wandering, he had been unhoused for many years, and just that moment when we got to talking and he was like, I didn't think that I would be able to return there, to find that place where I was reminded of when I was a child and these spiritual things were there for me, because he had felt so disconnected for so many years. And in Buddhism, interconnection is huge. And it's something that we talk about all the time, that all things in this world are connected. And so just finding that moment of interconnection was absolutely beautiful. And on a, well, maybe not a lighter note, but again, with the interconnection thing, one of the things I was thinking prior to that was, again, early on in my ministerial career, I went to go do a visit with a man who had called the temple, and he was Buddhist, but not from my particular tradition. However, we're happy to visit with and console those who need it. He was considering euthanasia because he had been suffering from cancer for a year or so, was in a lot of pain, but he had read something within one of the Buddhist texts that said that suicide was something that would land you in a terrible realm. And I was familiar enough with this text that I was able to talk with him for a bit. And we discussed various Buddhist doctrines, you know, the idea that he had made this decision with wisdom, which is very important. He had discussed it with his family. He knew what he was doing. And death is always painful, but you're not getting punished for making a decision that's good for you and everyone else. But again, moment of intersection. So he mentions the song Roadrunner by the Modern Lovers. My dad was in punk bands when I was a kid, so I grew up with a lot of 1970s, early 80s punk, and I knew the exact song that he was talking about. So we went from talking about these very heavy spiritual elements to him telling me the bands that he saw that came through. And I was like, oh my God, my dad was totally at that show. And oh my God, my dad had that record. And again, just these moments of being reminded that, like, that interconnectedness is real. And to be reminded of that all the time is really pivotal for me consistently.
Ramones. Yeah, so much. If you guys got to get to know Diana, she's amazing. And let's see the nails tonight too, FYI. Can we see him? No, nothing cool there? Side note, my oldest daughter, back when we lived here, every time Diana would come over, she'd be like, let me check out your nails. It was always a thing. So cool. So speaking of nails and Abraham Joshua Heschel, this idea of interconnectedness, we talked about like fostering this sense of awe and wonder. And I don't know if it's because I'm in my second half of life, I have two children, or I'm just ADD. I need spaces of contemplative meditative practices in my life. And I'm curious with you all, how do you foster contemplative practices? And maybe, perhaps if you want to dive into mysticism, now's your opportunity to do that. If you're like, no, I don't touch it, maybe talk about other spiritual practices, but things that are shaping you in order to then shape the people around you. What kind of things do you do to foster that?
You want me to start?
Anybody can start.
Unfortunately, in my upbringing, and as I've learned about some of the history of my faith, there has been a pretty significant section of Christianity where contemplative practices, meditation, and being one with yourself and one with your own thoughts was discouraged, because that puts you in touch with your emotions, it puts you in touch with maybe outside influences, it puts you in touch with things that maybe aren't so trustworthy. And so for a lot of my life, this was discouraged, and I had to learn how to do this as an adult. It's a hard time to learn how to do things. It's much easier to learn these things when you're young. And so I had to learn how to put in practices in my life that allowed me to be still and allowed me to be silent and allowed me to listen. I have a lot to say to God, and it turns out that there's a lot for me to learn and a lot for me to hear if I can shut up. And so learning to take time for silent meditation, practices of gratitude, practices of awe and wonder, as you mentioned. And for me, that usually takes place outside, usually takes place in a particularly alpine sort of setting. Usually I do prefer to be moving if I possibly can, but silent and alone, and the opportunity to just listen and hear what God might have to say to me. And that had played a significant role in shaping my faith and shaping what I believe. And it hasn't been the danger that I was told that it was going to be. And I've been deeply refreshed by those moments of contemplation and meditation to listen and to understand myself, which is another kind of scary layer of all of this, is when you're alone with yourself, you've got to learn to be with yourself. And I think there are a lot of people who are actually terrified of sort of what's under the surface. I know that was true for me in a lot of cases, and that might be true for you. but being just afraid of what you're going to find if you start to dig deeper and peel back some of the layers of the onion. And that's a really scary process. And sometimes it's really helpful to have people to help you along in that. It doesn't have to be something you do alone, whether it's a therapist or clergy or a friend or a mentor or something. That can be really key as well. But it's in those contemplative practices that a lot of times we discover not only God, but ourselves and who we really are, which again is sometimes frightening, but usually has a beautiful result if we're willing to see it through and press on through some of the difficult moments.
Thank you.
Okay, so with contemplative practices, as Ryan mentioned, my Buddhist tradition is not one that does meditation in terms of sitting quietly and contemplating. I have never been trained in it, but I do always encourage people, if they're going into it, yes, do it with a teacher, because you don't know what box of monsters you're going to open up in your little brain attic if you go into it. So it is very difficult. I think the biggest one that I have learned is listening to others, and especially as a minister. That is the best contemplative practice I can do, because we all have those moments where we're sitting with somebody else, and even now I find myself doing it. Oh, somebody's answering and I'm trying to answer my own question at the same time, and you're thinking about what you want to say instead of thinking about what the other person is saying and just being with them. That is one of the most important contemplative practices that I have learned, is that, what do they call, active listening, just being there with people when they need you to be there.
Thank you.
It took years of doing Yogananda's Self-Realization Fellowship program. It took two-year Jewish meditation training programs, and then hanging out with Buddhists some more, other kinds, to finally get this Jew to shut up and appreciate it. And meditation and mindfulness it's essential to my practice. It's essential. I agree with, it's like, what's going on? My brain's making up all sorts of stuff all the time. And it's such a relief to sit back in a non-judgmental way and notice what's going on, and then search for the divine in the quiet. My favorite place to pray is on a trail, but my second favorite place to pray is in Jewish community. And I could say a bunch about that, but in terms of this stuff, I did bring my Heschel quotes, and I'll just... So Abraham Joshua Heschel said, "Awareness of the divine begins with wonder. It is the result of what a human does with their higher incomprehension. The greatest hindrance to such awareness is our adjustment to conventional notions, to mental cliches. Wonder, or radical amazement, the state of maladjustment to words and notions, is therefore a prerequisite for an authentic awareness of that which is."
Awesome. Thank you. Another side note here, another guest we've had, Helen DeCruz, is a philosopher, and she just released a book called Wonderstruck, Exploring Awe and Wonder from a Philosophical Perspective. Interesting that we brought that intersection up again. So quickly, and then we'll have room for a few questions, as we kind of move from this internal space into more talking about community as a whole, what do you see the importance of intergenerational wisdom and storytelling in maybe your own life? Maybe that's a parent or a grandparent, or in your congregational setting, or maybe one of those teachers. Where does that intergenerational wisdom show up?
I'm going to answer with a story, a famous Hasidic story. When the great Rabbi Israel Baal Shem Tov saw misfortune, they were trying to come kill us, threatening the Jews, it was his custom to go to a certain part of the forest to meditate. There he would light a fire, he would say a special prayer, and the miracle would be accomplished and the misfortune averted. Later, when his disciple, the celebrated Maggid of Mezrich, had occasion, for the same reason, they were trying to come kill us again, to intercede with heaven, he would go to the same place in the forest and he would say, "Master of the universe, listen, I do not know how to light the fire, but I know how to, I am able to say the prayer, and I know where to be." And again, the disaster was averted. Still later, Rabbi Moshe Leib of Sassoff, in order to save his people once more from murderous attackers, would go into the forest and say, "I don't know how to light the fire. I don't know the prayer, but I know the place, and that has to be sufficient." And it was. And lastly, it fell to Rabbi Israel of Rizin, who was overcome with a misfortune, another attack. They came to kill us again. And he's sitting in his armchair, his head in his hands. He spoke to God and said, "I am unable to light the fire. I do not know the prayer. I cannot even find the place in the forest. All I can do is tell this story. And this must be sufficient." And it was. And Elie Wiesel added one line to the story and said, "God made man because he loves stories."
One of the most significant ways that I've had the opportunity to participate in an intergenerational perspective on life and faith has been to participate in what one of this practice that one of our elders has encouraged myself and others to do. And it's called creating a spiritual family tree. And what that involves is sort of going up the line in generation from your experiences with spirituality and faith, and then asking your parents about their experiences. And then if they're still alive, your parents. And if they're not alive, you can ask your parents about their parents, and going as far back as you possibly can, and creating kind of a family tree to sort of understand where you've come from. And in doing so, you get to interact with these various generations of faith and spirituality in your life. And you come to find that you usually are simultaneously a composite of all of the things that you've come from, and also a reaction to all of the things that you've come from. So many of the things that you believe or that I believe are influenced by where we've come from, and also a reaction to. Sometimes, you know, a negative reaction, like you might kind of juke one idea or the other. Maybe you've embraced a few things, but usually what we've done is used the things that have been passed down to us, whether explicitly or implicitly, as we've grown up. And one of the best ways for me to interact with sort of an intergenerational perspective on faith has been to do this practice of creating a spiritual family tree. There are books that can help you do this, but it's essentially as simple as I just said. And it also has this way of healing some divides that are sometimes between you and your parents or your siblings or whatever, because you kind of have to pick up the phone and call them and ask them some questions and talk to them about their faith and your faith. And it's amazing what can be healed sometimes in those conversations when you're simply interviewing and listening and asking questions. So that's been an important way for me to interact with this.
So with a lot of Buddhist traditions, lineage is very important within that. So you'll find that most Buddhist traditions have lineage, even scrolls within their temples, starting from the time of the historical Buddhas and down through all the various teachers, masters of the tradition. So we always leave space for that because of the historical Buddha, because of all the teachers that came after him, we are where we're at today. But we also have traditions within that. So my tradition does something every year in the summertime. It's called Obon, and it's a time when we gather together to remember those who have gone before us, and that could be family members, that could be friends, but again, it's that time of recalling interconnection. So because of this person, for better or for worse, no matter who they were, and I know having done a billion funerals already, nobody is a bad person after they've died for some reason, but we all know that things are difficult, life is messy, and the people in our lives, it can be complicated, but because of them, I am who I am today. And I can say, like, because of Steve, we've known each other many years, we've done many things together. Because of him, I am me. Janelle is part of who I am, Ryan is part of who I am. Nathan, now that I've met you this evening, you're in the line too, so you're in my larger fabric of life. So we do have this time of the year when we get together, and within Japanese tradition, we do folk dances together, but it's all a way of just remembering that we do not exist in a vacuum, that everything that has surrounded us in this life has come together as part of the weave of the fabric of who we are. And so the intergenerational and the storytelling is incredibly important, because without that, we cannot create our own selves.
Excellent. The three of you, I'm sure you have questions for each other. So this is your time they'll ask you questions at the very end. Oh, no. But do you have any questions for each other? No, nothing? Nothing right now? So if you don't, here's what we'll do. We're all adults, but it's weird because we stand up in a room and you make noise. You can use this time to get a drink because grandma's grandma, and she takes her time at the bar. I love grandma. She's amazing. So you can get up, go get a drink, and then we'll use this time as 10 minutes bathroom beer break. But do like 10 minutes of questions about this particular session, then we'll move to the next part in a bit. But you have to come up here and use the mic because you're on a podcast. Yes, this is eternally archived on the interweb, so whatever you say, it's there forever. I tell my kids that. Be careful.
I love that question about intergenerational communities, and often the conversation revolves around our elders or ancestors. I'm wondering if you guys have any words about the other direction, like children and teenagers, and how they are impactful in our intergenerational communities.
I wish I had a lot to say about that, but I would say I have been surprised by what my children have taught me. And usually it's because I was arrogant or lacked humility and thought that I understood something, a complex thing, better than they did. And then because they are reading and watching movies and interacting with the world, they're able to use metaphor a lot of times to teach me something in a way simpler way than I would have tried to explain it. And so I think one of the ways that I have learned from the next generation has been in the ways that they can simplify, beautifully simplify, things that I thought were really complex. And frankly, I probably made them more complex than they really were, just because it made me feel really good that I understood something complex. And so learning from my kids in the simplest ways, and usually through some form of metaphor where they can say, Dad, it's kind of like this, you know, it's kind of like this tree in our yard, or it's kind of like that character in that book that we're reading, or it's, you know, whatever it is. And their ability to make those connections is incredible. And I usually can't see those things. So I've learned a ton about God, myself, the world, in listening to my kids make connections using other things through metaphor to simplify things that I'd created a overly complex scenario.
I think one of my favorite parts of the ministry is working with the kids, because A, of their unabashed weirdness, they just do and say whatever is on their minds. And I think that's fabulous, because it's a great place for us to be. Because as adults, we get so serious about everything. And yes, that's simplifying things. And even if it's not where you were going, it brings some levity to the situation. I was reading a book to our kids during one of our services recently, and the book had to do with one friend writing a letter to another friend. And after I was done, I was like, oh my gosh, you kids, do you guys even know what letters are? And one of the kids immediately started singing the alphabet song to me, which was hilarious. And just things like that, it's so wonderful that you can learn to just, okay, maybe let me take a step back and stop. Things sometimes aren't that serious, and it's okay to see things in just that silly kid way that children are able to do, able to simplify things in ways that sometimes we can't. So I think the intergenerational looking towards the younger generation too is really important for us, because it brings us back to our true selves, the people we were when we weren't trying to be somebody specific. And so, yeah, I find that very important.
So I'll take a slightly different tack. In our communities that have lots of ritual, most of them have places where kids are involved. And So what I want to say is how important that is, how important it is to be, you know, it can be, if you choose for that, to have your kids in a community, first of all, an intergenerational community where they can run around and there's like, it's a village, right? Everybody's watching your kid. Your kid's used to being out in the village, knowing there's other adults around that they can trust. Then they also have ritual moments that they can participate in and test out their competencies. At a bar or bat mitzvah, a child leads the service. The whole idea is the kid leads the service, or at least parts of it, and teaches Torah to everyone else in the room. So they actually have a ritualized moment to teach all of us at age 13. And some of the teachings that they do at age 13 are pretty boring, but some of them are astonishing. My daughters, I made sure, by the way, when my daughter's bat mitzvah happened, I did not know what she was going to say. I had other people work with her, so I didn't know. Blew my mind. So for me, that's kind of a combo of some of the things you're talking about, the value of community and having places and ritual where we do stuff together regularly. Kids remember that time of year when we do that stuff, and they know, looking forward, that there'll be other opportunities to do that stuff.
I think this flows in well with what you were saying about ritual. I'm right now reading The Power of Ritual by Caspar Turkile from Harvard Divinity School. One of the things that he talks about is people leaving faith, the faith traditions that they were brought up in, but then reconnecting with different aspects of spirituality in different ways. And one of those aspects is pilgrimage. I'm curious how you have experienced concept of pilgrimage, what that looks like in each of your different faiths, how maybe a pilgrimage has impacted you in your life.
The summer before my daughter's November bat mitzvah, we took her on what we called her Israel love tour. And we had a weird agenda, being weird parents. We wanted her to see the other faiths in Israel, not just the Jewish ones. That was a whole other story. But she had her calling to the Torah, which is normally happens for the first time at her bat mitzvah. She had it with a group called Women of the Wall on the new moon at the Western Wall. And we wanted her to have an experience. So this is for minorities. There's no place else on the planet I can go that I'm not a minority. And so for me to go to make a pilgrimage to a place where my culture, my language, my holidays, my rituals, my language, my religion are the majority is totally, when I did that for the first time, it changed my life. I was like, oh my God, the world looks completely different now. I had no idea what it was like to get on a bus and realize I'm with the majority of the people on this bus. I've never had that experience anywhere else. So that's one kind of pilgrimage. But the other one I was thinking about was a trip some of us took with the Multi-Faith Leadership Forum to Montgomery, to the sites in Montgomery. I consider that one of, if not the most important pilgrimage for every American to take. And I'm not sure the connection here other than I call it a pilgrimage.
I think it was maybe 10 or 12 years ago. My wife can probably remember better. We went and visited Israel and went to Jerusalem, and we went to Bethlehem in the West Bank and got to walk in the footsteps of Jesus, and getting to, similar to your experience, not because it felt like
I... what it was like to be a minority.
Yeah, exactly. It was maybe the other way around. But it felt very much like I could now envision some of the things that I had only read about. I now could sort of, I don't know, taste, smell, see, touch, like my senses were able to interact with something that was only kind of theoretical. As much as I had given myself to understanding those things, it was still just an idea until I got to see it and experience it. And then this last summer, I mentioned earlier, we got to go to Scotland and kind of follow in the footsteps of one of my heroes, Frederick Douglass, and just sort of stand in some of the places where he stood. You know, there were some plaques and there were some murals and there was, you know, a bunch of like rundown buildings that are no longer in use that he taught in and things like that. And similarly, it probably didn't look anything like what it looked like when he was there teaching and when he was on his tour, but it connected me to that place. And there's something really special about being connected to a location, to a geography. And yeah, I think that probably all of our, whatever faith you espouse, has some sort of geographic rootedness somewhere. And when you have the opportunity to go and pilgrim to that place, it will shift the experience that you have for a long time to come, maybe forever. It's a really special thing. So, yeah, I highly recommend that if you're able to do that. Connect your faith to a place and then go to that place and experience it.
Yeah, I absolutely echo. I've been to Israel as well. Spatial joy is something that's been more profound to me lately, whether I'm at Red Rocks at a concert or last August when we were at Parliament and then Janelle and I got to go to Wrigley. Yes, that was a pilgrimage. It was sacred, very holy. So speaking of, it really was powerful. If you've never been to Wrigley, or if even a Fenway had a similar feeling. So speaking of baseball, and you're all still seated, let's do a little seventh inning stretch because you're probably a little tired. Grandma seats a little hard on the derriere. Stretch, take me out to the ball game. We're going to continue this conversation talking about community now. We're shifting gears in about 3 minutes.
Thanks so much for listening to the Brew Theology podcast and our live podcast event, Soul Brew, recorded in early April. We're so glad you could join us. If you have any questions, you can find us at brewtheology.org, at Brew Theology on Facebook and Instagram, and at brew_theology on Twitter. If you'd like to talk to one of us, you can email Ryan or Janelle at brewtheology.org. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll play part 2 for you next week. Cheers!